This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to Specsaver, sir. How can I help?
Hello. I'm a senior, and I've heard that for eligible seniors, of which I am one, Specsavers are giving 50% off lens upgrades on their glasses, like thinner and lighter lenses or a sun tint. For seniors.
You don't look senior. You have to be 65 or over to get this offer.
Here's my ID, which is definitely not a fake.
Yeah, this says you were born in 1877.
Happy birthday
to me. Seniors get 50% off lens upgrades at Specsavers. Conditions and exclusions apply. See specsavers.ca.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And it's fitting that the day after our Zoomer Radio Radiothon, which raised a record $76,700, we have news about another donation that should move the science in a significant way. So philanthropist and businessman Peter Gilgan is donating $50 million for research on early detection. And early detection is the holy grail when it comes to cancer treatment. And some of the most difficult, low survival cancers remain intractable because they are usually diagnosed late. As a matter of fact, about 50% of cancers are diagnosed at later stages when treatment is more difficult and uncertain. And a personal cancer story out of the U.S., another Kennedy family tragedy. Tatiana Schlossberg, the 35-year-old daughter of Caroline Kennedy, has disclosed a terminal cancer diagnosis, and she did so in an essay where she trashed her uncle, Health and Human Services head RFK Jr., who seems often to be very anti-science, and who, in the meantime, has appointed another anti-vaxxer as his second in command. So, the numbers to call if you have questions, comments, or want to share something about your cancer story. The numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, former head of BC Cancer, and also a former physician in chief at the Princess Margaret, specializing in some of those very low survival cancers. Dr. Fahad Razak, a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hello and welcome to you all.
Hi, Libby.
Hello. Hi, Libby.
Okay, let us begin with Malcolm. And so we're just hearing about this huge $50 million donation. In recent weeks, we've had news about advances in blood tests, which the hope is they can diagnose cancers early. Why has this been so difficult?
Thanks, Libby. So, first of all, just I would be remiss if I didn't start by thanking you and the Zoomer listeners for your strong advocacy for Princess Margaret and the listeners for supporting the research work. Because the reality is in Canada that we do rely a lot on philanthropy for research. Research is where advances come from. And so we're very grateful to everyone for supporting the work that we do. Now, if I may, I'll take a bit of a moment here and explain why this is such a significant effort, and also kind of how we've built on previous investments in research. So 15 years ago, everyone would agree that the place to invest in cancer was genetics, understanding the genetics of the tumor. And people built big genetic centers, which allowed you to take a tumor, identify the mutations in the tumor that caused the cancer, and hopefully then get a better treatment for the cancer. From that, the technology evolved to the extent that you don't even need to take a piece of the tumor anymore. You can just take a blood sample from a cancer patient, and you can little fragments of cancer cells are in the blood, and you can actually identify the mutations from the blood. And so then when that technology became available, people started to think, well, wait a minute. You know, if you have colon cancer and it's removed, there's a 50% chance that it might come back. And so we give 100% of cases chemotherapy to prevent that. The reality is 50% of the people don't need it. Is there a way of, you know, identifying whether the cancer is still there? And so these blood tests evolved, which allowed you to predict pretty accurately which patients who've had surgery, the cancer is going to come back. The next step in this is somebody sort of said, wait a minute, if we can detect small pieces of cancer in the blood in cancer patients, what about if we started doing this in people who don't have cancer as a screening test for cancer? And, you know, right now our screening tests for cancer, I would say, are relatively crude. We do mammography for breast cancer, looking for lumps. We do CT scans for lung cancer, again, looking for lumps. But by the time a tumor is a centimeter in diameter, it's been there probably for years, and it's doubled probably 20 or 30 times. What you really want to do is identify the cancer when it's first developing, because you're much more likely to be able to eradicate it with treatment. And now, with these new technologies, we are able to actually screen people and identify the mutations. The challenge at the moment is, let's say we took a blood sample on 100 of our listeners, and in two of them we saw evidence of cancer. The question is, what do you do next? Because this cancer may not show up on traditional CT scanning and imaging. And that's why this technology really needs to stay in the research domain for the moment. And I think what this big donation, this transformational gift, will do is allow us to understand, what do we do in someone who feels well, looks well, CT scan is normal, but based on a blood test, we think there's a cancer somewhere. And I think this is really an important step forward, because the smaller the cancer, the earlier you detect it, the higher chance of cure. So this is a very exciting new program that's been created.
It's very exciting, very complicated. And Fahad, the reality, though, is still 50% of cancers are detected at late stages. We know that during the pandemic, when people couldn't get those, what Malcolm referred to as relatively crude screenings like mammograms, there was a spike. So what is your view of this?
Yeah, I just want to start by, well, first of all, what an amazing overview by Malcolm as someone who's kind of led in this space for decades. I want to start by just recognizing the critical role of people like Peter Gilligan. I have never met him. I don't have any conflicts of interest. But I want to say, as I look at the landscape, this is an individual and his family, through their foundation, which has made these pivotal investments in healthcare and research across the system, not just Princess Margaret. There's a tower at my hospital named after them as well. So just my significant thanks, because if I look out on the world, the reality is that it is this joint model of government and philanthropy, which pushes ahead critical healthcare delivery and research and other areas. So I just want to start by recognizing that. Now, look, what is the role of this? So let me give a very specific example that I think is maybe very illustrative. One of the most important early cancer detection technologies that seems to be evolving rapidly right now is the idea that some of the mutations in those first few cells that are developing, that are becoming cancerous, could leak into the blood. And you could find samples of those mutations in the blood if you screen with a highly sense of the blood test. And this is called cell-free DNA. This is being now tested at scale in the United Kingdom. And the question is, can Canada catch up through investments like this? And I think we can. And in order to do the studies at scale, because cancers are relatively rare in young people, and because you need to screen many, many people early 40s, 50s, 60s to try and identify those cancers, before you need literally hundreds of thousands of people. So this now overlaps with my area of interest, which is that, can you use the digital health infrastructures of a country or a province to find all of the people who could be eligible and benefit from a technology like this, contact them, and offer them the chance to participate? And that is what's happening in the UK now. They contacted 1.5 million people using the National Health Service records, and they said, there is this new technology. Would you like to participate? And 150,000 people stepped forward, put their hands up, and are in a randomized trial now. In Canada, we cannot do that today, or in Ontario, but we are on the cusp of being able to do that. It is an evolution of our culture. It is an idea of saying, we're going to use our health data now, not only for direct healthcare delivery, but for things like this, finding people who are eligible, allowing them the chance to participate. And I always point to the example of my mom, who, Windsor, Ontario, blue collar town, developed MS at age 30 in a wheelchair within 2 years. She's now 75. She's never been offered the chance to be in a randomized trial because she's in a blue collar town. That, I think, is a significant equity issue. We should extend the opportunity to all Canadians, all people in Ontario, not just those who are in the catchment of Princess Margaret or St. Michael's. And so the digital technologies have the ability to do that and are a very nice pairing to the investment that was announced today.
Interesting. Sorry to hear about your mom, but glad to hear that she's okay. Now, Alisa, whenever we hear about advances that are really looking to the future, I'm sure that in your practice, it means that some of your patients are going to come and say, hey, I want this.
That's right. People will definitely come. So there's different types of people. So there's some people who exist that are people who want to know everything at any time, so that anything that can be done in the future, like anything that can prevent something from the future, they want to have every single test possibly done. And then there's the opposite person, the person who doesn't want to know anything. And so what you'll see is that there will be a bunch of people who will come forward who will want to go and have this testing done. And I think what's so important about this testing is that the testing will be done within Princess Margaret, and that it will be housed there, so that when things are identified, as Dr. Moore explained, that things will then be able to be properly followed up, as opposed to things being done through a private medicine lens, where then it gets punted back to the private to the public healthcare system, and then I don't know what I'm doing as a primary care doctor to go and figure out what's wrong with this patient. So this hopefully we'll be able to revolutionize how we are practicing medicine and how we are going about preventative care and in terms of the screening that will be offered.
Malcolm, a couple of questions. So you're talking about what to do with a finding of a very small cancer. And one of the issues that I hear about from oncologists, especially in the very difficult cancers and the aggressive forms of them, like pancreatic cancer or stomach cancer, is that often cancers, even if you follow a patient, they kind of emerge in between the screenings. So how would advances in detection deal with that, or what could deal with that?
You know, that's a very good question, right? Because so as we become more sophisticated in our genetic understanding of cancer, you do have the ability to look at a profile, let's say a profile of mutations, and say, this is most consistent with a pancreatic cancer. So let's say that you do that in someone, and then you do an MRI or a CT of the pancreas, and you don't see anything, right? So I think what's going to start to happen is those people will be selected for more extensive screening. So that is, they will have these tests done more frequently, and as soon as there's any sign of an abnormality, you intervene. as opposed to, let's say, for pancreatic cancer, if you wait until someone turns yellow because the tumor's obstructed the bile duct, then in the majority of cases, it's too late. The cancer's already spread. So I think what you're going to start to see is that the people who test positive for these cell-free DNAs, we call it ctDNA, circulating tumor DNA tests, the people who are positive, A, will have the test done more frequently, because if it is a cancer, then the level should continue to grow, and they'll have these enhanced screening programs. And hopefully, if we do that, we certainly will detect cancer at earlier stages.
While I have you, I want to ask about an advance, not Princess Margaret this time, Sunnybrook, involved in a very small trial of patients with glioblastoma, which is a very aggressive brain cancer. It's the one that killed Gord Downie. This, to me, like, I couldn't even wrap my head around it. It was so kind of sci-fi, where some kind of microscopic bubbles to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And in this very small trial, patients both had longer progression-free survival and longer survival. What did you make of that?
Okay, let me try to quickly explain the blood-brain barrier. So the problem with brain tumors is that they spread locally in the brain. And just as a contrast, if you have colon cancer, you've got, let's say, a one-inch tumor, some of the cells may have gone a little bit further in the colon, but you can take out, 12 inches of the colon without any adverse effects. You hook up the colon, so you can take out all the surrounding tissues. You can't do that in the brain. If somebody has a one-inch tumor in the brain, you can't take out an additional 2 or 3 inches of brain tissue because, you'll lose your ability to walk, speak, etc. So the surgery has to be very local, and the real problem is the remaining cells that are around where the tumor was. And part of the challenge has been is that physiologically we've developed this thing called a blood-brain barrier, which is a good thing, which prevents a lot of toxins which get into our system from getting into the brain, which is obviously a good thing because the brain is very sensitive to all kinds of toxins, bacteria, etc. You don't really want infections, organisms getting into the brain. The challenge has been that when you start to look at drug treatment of brain tumors, we give these treatments into the blood, and if they can't get from the blood into the brain, they really can't have a positive effect. And it's been known for some time that when people have brain tumors, if you give them some sort of injectable or oral drug, very little of that drug actually gets to the brain, which is where you want it to get. So people have started to study, can you temporarily, like you can't live without a blood-brain barrier, are there ways to temporarily disrupt the blood-brain barrier, give a drug, allow the drug to get in, and then allow the blood-brain barrier to function again to protect the brain from all other things? And I think that's what this research at Sunnybrook is about. When they talk about these bubbles, ultrasound, what they're really talking about is a strategy to temporarily disrupt the blood-brain barrier to allow a drug to get in, and then when you stop, the blood-brain barrier comes back, and the brain is protected from all other toxins. So that's what they're doing, and I think this is sort of a first preliminary step to sort of say, can we safely do this, and is there some evidence that this might help things? So it's an interesting area. It's not an area we talk about very much, but as you say, glioblastoma brain tumors are not rare, and people like Gord Downie have obviously brought more profile to this. It's a terrible illness.
That was a great explanation. It's still kind of sci-fi to me. If we have time to talk about what's going on in the States, Fahd, this is for you, and this is a general stat. So for this year, healthcare spending in Canada is expected to grow nearly 2 percentage points faster than the economy. And all I can say is that's not good.
Yeah, look, we cannot spend our way out of the healthcare problem. There simply is not the resources to extend this out. And we are not, I'll say this, you know, in as diplomatic a tone as possible, we are not running an efficient system. We're not. Like, look, there's lots of people who are trying. I think I'm trying. Malcolm's trying. Alyssa's trying. But as a system, we are not running an efficient system. And I really believe that the healthcare system as an industry, because it is an industry, it's a huge part of our economy, it's a huge part of where our taxpayer dollars go, it has not harnessed the efficiency measures that a lot of other parts of the system have, what you see in finance, what you see in engineering, what you see in law, and specifically the use of data to make things more equitable, more efficient, supply chain, processes of care, all the things that are required. It hasn't made that leap. You see it every day. You know, Libby, you endlessly rib us about the fax machine, and the fax machine is emblematic of the fact, I think, that those advances have not happened. And I'm not saying that some advances haven't happened. Of course they have. But the way to think about the rising cost measures is not just to spend more. It is to look to create a system that's more efficient and harnessing modern technology, which unfortunately is just not the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, we keep saying that. So what's your thought on what's the holdup?
We are not bold in healthcare to the extent that we need to be. I just got back from Denmark last week, meeting with the Danish government and the Danish Health Authority. And, you know, they have this model, which is really interesting. They essentially run their health system on 5 to 10 year plans, and then they blow up the system and recreate it based on the way that technology has shifted within that window. That is not failure when they blow it up and reset it. That is recognizing that technology changes dramatically within these cycles, and you need to have a system which can really be recreated around the most available modern technology in each cycle. And I think that the idea here is that we incrementally build on a system, but we have the legacies of antiquated technology. Again, the fax machine being emblematic of that. You know, if you had a blow up of the system today, of course, the fax machine would not be part of the next system you build. There's no way, right? But it is there because we don't blow up the system. We have legacy technologies and we incrementally build on them. It's just a different way of looking at the world. And I do wonder if that has led us to certain kind of almost evolutionary traps where we fall into a certain kind of problem in the health system, which you can't just iteratively improve. You fundamentally have to shift to new technologies.
Alyssa, you work in an Ontario health team, which is holy grail might be too strong, but that's where it's kind of the next iteration of the system. It's supposed to be the most efficient. It's not your fault that there are things you have to use a fax machine for. But do you feel like it is efficient?
So the system is definitely not efficient. I was reflecting back over the last week or so of how much time am I like actually annoyed with like system problems that are out of the control of me as the practitioner or our clinic or even the patient. And probably at least an hour and a half of my day is taken up with just things have nothing to do with patient care. It creates frustration for me. It creates frustration for the patient. And the system is just so inefficient. And the system has just become so complex. The amount of information coming in, the information going out, referrals, medications, just everything. And we're stuck like 100%. The fax is just ridiculous that we have these conversations. And I'll be like to the patient, well, I need to fax to where you want this to go. And they have this like, what are you talking about? Fax? Because nobody uses a fax, right? And I'm like, I can.
Most of your patients probably don't even know what it is.
You know, some I still have like talking legacy technology. There's some patients that still have a home fax. It's like actually crazy. But the system just bogs down. It doesn't work efficiently. And listen, there needs to be like real change that needs to happen. And unfortunately, how healthcare funding works is that usually governments don't last more than 5 years or 10 years would be like unheard of. And so It costs money now to invest in the future to bring about this change, but that cost is expensive and you're not going to see the benefit of the cost, and there's going to be growing pains and people will be frustrated. And so we exist within the system that just fundamentally does not work, and it creates a lot of problems that don't have to exist, and it creates a daily struggle that just makes things so hard. Like, I'll get emails from patients about this doctor's not getting back to me or this or this, and I'm like, it doesn't even involve me. And it's just all of this time. And like, one simple thing that we could do, well, it's not simple, but if we just had a standard process for referrals where it went to some centralized location, it would make things just so much more efficient. And there are systems that exist and referral pathways that exist, and the pathways work really well, but it doesn't work. This doesn't exist within the system. And if we created a centralized booking thing, it would help so much. Referrals wouldn't be lost. Patients wouldn't have trouble reaching the doctor where the referral was sent. It would just make things just so much easier. Those are the touch points. When there's interfaces between the patient within the system, it creates frustration because these touch points don't move efficiently and there's blockages. And then everybody ends up getting frustrated and then the whole system bogs down.
I think you nailed it down there. I don't even know if we have time for me to, even the technology glitches. So I'm going to wrap the things up with a little story of mine, and it has to do with the system UHN uses, Epic. And I don't know, probably now nearly 2 years ago, I had an appointment for something that turned out to be nothing. And I didn't even see the senior doctor. I saw a resident. All good. But the system keeps sending me follow-ups, and we can't get rid of it. And I've emailed the doctor directly, and he said, don't worry about it. Ignore it. And I just keep getting these things that I don't need, and I want to be canceled so somebody who needs it can get it. But it's just a lot of glitchy stuff. So I guess all of these things, we're going to keep talking about them, but we have great news on the cancer front. And people, you can still donate through the ZoomerRadiothon.ca until next Tuesday, which is Giving Tuesday. So if you haven't gotten around to it, please do so. Thank you so much to our doctors, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Fahad Razak, and Dr. Malcolm Moore, and we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, we're taking a break, and when we come back, over this last week, the Ford government has unveiled a raft of justice measures. I think it's called something like keeping criminals behind bars or something like that. And we'll get a couple different views on it when we come back.
Welcome to Specsavers, sir. How can I help?
Hello. I'm a senior, and I've heard that for eligible seniors, of which I am one, Specsavers are giving 50% off lens upgrades on their glasses, like thinner and lighter lenses or a suntint. For seniors.
You don't look senior. You have to be 65 or over to get this offer.
Here's my ID, which is definitely not a fake.
Yeah, this says you were born in 1877.
Happy birthday
seniors
to
seniors get 50% off lens upgrades at Specsavers. Conditions and exclusions apply. See specsavers.ca.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as we have been reporting, the Ford government has tabled a raft of tough-on-crime measures, including Andrew's Law, which is a measure to get tough on dangerous driving. And there's also that requirement that people accused of a crime or the people who are their sureties have to provide a cash security deposit up front rather than what is in place now, which is just a promise of payment later if they break their bail conditions. And this is also coming with a promise to open 1,000 new jail beds, because one of the arguments is, well, our jails are already overcrowded. We can't take more people in jail. So it's fair to say, I think, that most defense lawyers oppose these measures, but not Ari Goldkind, who joins me now. Hi, Ari.
Just before we start, Libby, I got to say something. I just listened to that ad for the Humane Society Shelter Pet of the Week. That is awesome. That is awesome. So whoever came up with that idea at Zoomer deserves a raise and a good head rub, because that's where I got my late dog of 15 years from the Toronto Humane Society. And I hope people listen to that and go rescue doggies, because I thought that ad was amazing. Back to your question.
Okay, so that's my question. So this requirement, which I think is in opposition to the federal law, that people have to come up with cash bail. You think it's okay? Most of your colleagues don't.
Yeah, of course they don't. And of course I do. I mean that with some levity, but I tend to look at things a little differently than most. And I look at things through the lens of both a criminal defense lawyer and a taxpaying, actually incredibly high taxpaying citizen who thinks that things can be improved. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. The real concern here, and I'm not going to speak for other defense lawyers, they can speak for themselves. The real concern here of people who might be opposed to this is the belief that if you're poor, you're not likely to get bail, or that there'll be sort of a two or three tier system that only wealthy people get out. First of all, that's not going to happen. And second of all, it is already happening. It's been happening for years. There are a ton of homeless and mentally ill people who are not really dangerous, who don't get out because they don't have mommy and daddy to come sign bail. They don't have best friends or spouse to come sign bail. So they languish in custody. And I just did a bail hearing, Libby, and this would interest you. I did a bail hearing not 2 weeks ago where a justice of the peace kept somebody in because their surety was on ODSP, and the conclusion was that if a surety has no money, they'll be no good. I thought that was offensive. So anybody who thinks this system is working the way it should right now is wrong. All that's happened here, and this is why the changes are misunderstood. First of all, you're going to have judges and justices of the peace extraordinarily vigilant that there isn't a two-tier system and poor people aren't warehoused. Number two, if you have a surety for somebody who is a violent criminal and has a bad criminal record and has 10 entries, but the person is releasable, they do check the right boxes to get out, and the surety has $15,000 in the bank, it surprises a lot of your listeners to know that none of that money has to be put down currently. It's just a promise that the accused is going to be a good boy. And if the accused isn't a good boy, there's very little recourse all that often for the surety. All the Ford government is doing now is saying, look, we're going to make you have a bit more skin in the game. We're going to put more consequences into this. And Libby, whether you're on Zoomer or on children's programming, if there's no consequences for what a surety takes on, or they can turn a blind eye or not report the person or not supervise them 24/7 the way they're promising, if there's no consequences, what do we think's going to happen? Put $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 down now into the kitty. I think that's going to improve the quality of suretyship, and I would debate that with anybody till the cows come home.
I would think so, but I'm thinking of the people who are the sureties. I mean, even if you have, say, a child who is a bad child, you still love them, want to support them. And what if you don't have that $5,000 in the kitty?
And that's why this is misunderstood. It's not like bails are going to be set at amounts that people can't afford. When somebody comes to court to be a surety, usually it's called the named surety. I don't want to get too into the weeds. I'm sure you have an ad break we're coming up on. But if somebody comes to court and they have $1,000 in the bank and they're a great surety, you're not going to have a surety bail set at $10,000 that they have to put down. That's not going to happen. If it happens, I will be the first defense lawyer, joining with my other defense lawyer colleagues, to take that straight to a superior court, where a superior court judge, let's just say, won't put up with that. So there is this misperception that somehow now we're going to be like the United States with a $1 million bond. It's not really real. It's 10% if anybody's ever seen The Midnight Run. All that the rules are now saying is if you're going to put up money as a promise, we're going to ask that there be a cash deposit to it a lot of the time, most of the time. And by the way, Libby, if you and I walk down the street right now in Liberty Village or wherever you'd like to go for a walk with me, and you said to people, hey, if a violent person who's got a bad track record gets a $20,000 bail, do you think the surety's putting down a few bucks, or do you think it's just a promise? Most people today would think they have to put something down. This is not reinventing the wheel.
Okay. Thanks for explaining that. And as I've been saying since I saw this, it was very recently that I was very surprised to learn that nobody has to put any money
down. And just think quickly, Libby, how well-read and well-informed you are about the system. It's very surprising. And by the way, the Ford government deserves a bit of kudos. Tucked in there are some good changes to drunk driving and some excellent changes to animal welfare. But nobody's talking about those today.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks, Ari. Let's bring in Joseph Neuberger, who is a criminal defense lawyer with Neuberger & Partners. Hi, Joseph.
Hey, Libby. How are you?
Fine. Now, I'm assuming you disagree with Ari. Tell us why.
Well, my first concern is with respect to the jurisdiction of the province of Ontario, that anything is outside sort of just the administration of criminal justice. So there is a clear delineation with respect to criminal law legislation, and that is solely within the purview of the federal government. So they create the laws that define the criminal offenses, including the process and provisions that are in the criminal code. So bail is one of those. I need to read this legislation when it's actually tabled, because I'm not sure how, from a jurisdictional standpoint, they're able to impose that it is mandated whenever there is a surety release with a amount of money, a quantum, that it has to be deposited in full. So my first concern and objection to it is that they are going into federal jurisdiction, and that will cause challenges that can, of course, go up to the Ontario Court of Appeal and, if necessary, Supreme Court of Canada. And I think it's a constitutional issue that I think is problematic. That's my first comment. Second, I'm unclear as to whether this applies to a person who is first time within the system versus somebody who might be a repeat offender, because judges and justices of the peace have absolute power now to require deposits. And we have that with individuals who are coming into Ontario and commit offenses. Often there is a deposit required, and that has to be fulfilled. So I'm concerned about this being administered across any person who comes into the system. And just like you said, I do have concerns about an ability of people to come up with the cash to make the deposit versus securing it by showing that they have ownership of some assets. So those are my first two areas of concern.
Okay, but in general, do you think it's a good idea for people who say, I'm going to put money up, I'm going to watch this person, have more skin in the game, just to boil it down? Good idea, bad idea?
Look, I'm not opposed to it, but I think it should not be mandated the way the province is doing it now. I object to the legislation's title. Not everybody who's charged is guilty of an offense. They are presumed innocent, and from my practice alone, one out of three cases I defend are demonstrably false. So this can apply to individuals who are factually innocent and could be trapped in jail awaiting somebody coming up with the cash. So I'm concerned about one type of policy fits all. That will not work. I think encouragement should have been given to the prosecutors to seek cash bail deposits on surety releases, as opposed to mandating it through legislation. So I think in that respect, it's a bad idea. I think JPs requiring more deposits and higher quantums when people have breached their charge with very serious offenses, including violent offenses, I think that's a good idea. Because you're holding people accountable, and that may cause a surety to think twice about volunteering in that position. The other stuff which is missing, which I do support from the provincial government, is funding to prosecutors for units to go after people who are sureties and there have been breaches and they haven't done their job. So you're seeking the money that they put up. So I think investing in those prosecutorial teams is very good. I think investing in police for the bail check requirements is a very good thing. And I think creating a database, if I read that correctly, they want to create a provincial database that includes people who volunteered as sureties and who have been as sureties. And there you can have a database of information of those who've been on one or two or more releases where there have been breaches and they may no longer be appropriate. So that could be part of the Crown's check on an individual when they propose. So those, I think, are robust options available. I'm very concerned about this legislation mandating in all cases where there is a quantum in place that there has to be a full deposit. I'm very concerned about that and the practicality of affecting that in a timely manner.
Okay. You mentioned data. I mean, I think the provinces could be using data a lot better on a whole lot of different fronts. We only
yes.
have a few minutes left. The Andrews Law, the dangerous driving law, is that enough? Because this horrible crash happened while he was waiting to go back before a judge on the smaller crash that involved the premier. So this law would take people's licenses for at least 30 days. Is that enough? Do you think that will change the problem?
I think they should mimic as it is for impaired driving, which is 90 days. So I agree with that. So if you're charged with dangerous operation, and there's a wide range of cases of dangerous operation, but you know the example you have is very bad. And I think dangerous driving is one of those offenses where you and I and everybody else on the roads are very vulnerable. So an administrative suspension of 90 days upon charge, just like they have with impaired driving, I think is absolutely appropriate, and that may help. Problem is, there are many people who will commit further offenses and pay zero attention to the fact that their driver's license is suspended, unfortunately. So it's a reality, but I think this is a meaningful step forward.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Joseph Neuberger. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, we're taking another break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Mayor Patrick Brown about the latest on that horrible fire where the death toll is now 5 people when we return.
Welcome to Specsavers, sir. How can I help?
Hello. I'm a senior, and I've heard that for eligible seniors, of which I am one, Specsavers are giving 50% off lens upgrades on their glasses, like thinner and lighter lenses or a sun tint. For seniors.
You don't look senior. You have to be 65 or over to get this offer.
Here's my ID, which is definitely not a fake.
Yeah, this says you were born in 1877.
Happy birthday
seniors
to
seniors get 50% off lens upgrades at Specsavers. Conditions and exclusions apply. See specsavers.ca.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now to update that terrible fire in Brampton where the death toll is up to 5. The Toronto Star is reporting that the landlord has pushed back on claims that he failed to comply with directives from the city to address deficiencies and to allow inspectors on the property. Now, Mayor Patrick Brown stands by his claims, but what I want to know is where does ultimate enforcement kick in? Because we know there are bad landlords. Can the city actually shut down a dangerous rental? And Mayor Patrick Brown joins me now. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure to join your show.
Okay, first of all, so this landlord says, no, he's not an absentee landlord, and no, he didn't allow lots of people, to live in an illegal basement unit.
Yeah, I saw the comments in the Toronto Star by the landlord's lawyer, and I'm sure they're doing their own damage control, and I suspect they're concerned about potential criminal negligence. What I would say is the order to comply was sent to the landlord. It's a landlord's responsibility to make sure that their building meets building code and fire code and there's not illegal units. The notion that they'd be blaming the tenant is like victim blaming. If there is an illegal rental there in your property that you're not aware of, it's the landlord's responsibility. And I can tell you there's been a history on this location dating back to 2019 with this property. Initially, the city was refused attempts to enter. The city can't enter without permission. Eventually, the city got in and made instructions on what was needed to meet compliance. They said they were no longer pursuing a secondary unit. Then, of course, in the wake of this tragedy, we've now seen that there was ads online for a secondary unit, and there was a secondary unit there that did not have permission. And so we'll know more detail once the fire marshal completes the investigation. But in general, I want to say the city of Brampton is really focused on making sure that we have safe conditions for housing. And we're not going to tolerate housing that does not meet building code or fire code.
Okay, so we know, and not just in Brampton, that there are rentals that are rented out to way too many people. I mean, basically exploit people, often immigrants, new Canadians, and that they're dangerous. And I want to know, so the city says we want to inspect or you have to comply, but is there, a point at which you can just shut it down saying, there are 10 people in this basement apartment and it's dangerous?
Yeah, we had one case where there was a fire and there was 25 students living in the same rental unit. And so, you know, there has been some deplorable conditions that we've discovered. Under the current legislative framework in Ontario, bylaw cannot enter without permission. If the fire department has proof of a compliance issue, then they can enter. But to get the proof, you need to enter. And some of these, the good landlords will say to bylaw, of course, come in and inspect. The slum landlords will refuse entry and obstruct the city's ability to see where there's compliance issues. And if you prevent inspection, then the fire department would not even have the proof to enter. What I would add to this is that the city of Brampton has launched in January of 2024, a pilot project called the Residential Rental Licensing Program that treats rental units as businesses, and the city does have a right to enter a business. We've launched this project in the downtown wards of Brampton, and we have brought hundreds of illegal units into compliance. And now, today, at our city council, we have a motion being put forward to expand this program citywide that I think would be a wise decision for the city.
And is there any, first of all, is there any progress on finding out what actually happened in this case?
In terms of the Bananas Way tragedy, I'm told that's going to take some time for the fire marshal's office to do their work and to see what compliance issues might have existed. You know, it has been pointed out to me from the fire department that if you look at the online ad for this illegal unit, that it looks like the smoke detectors have been removed. But you know, that's just from the ad that was found on the internet, whether they added smoke detectors. First of all, there's no permissions to have a secondary unit there. So we know that there's already a compliance issue on that. But in terms of if there's any fire code or building code issues, we'll find out once the fire marshal completes their investigation.
Now, what was in that ad? Was it a walkthrough of the place? Tell me about that ad.
Yeah, they're on House Sigma. It's still up right now. They're advertising a rental unit in the basement that they and they were claiming that there was no rental unit in the basement. So obviously, if you're trying to rent a unit that you say there's no unit there, then we already know that there's been some misleading information shared.
Well, I would think that a lot of these online ads are a sort of a fertile ground for some type of enforcement.
Yes, and part of the challenge is the ability to enter. And it's why this RRL program is so important. This treating rental units as a business gives us the right to enter and inspect. And there's no cost to be part of this program. All we want is the basic right to inspect that the rental unit meets building code and fire code. And you wouldn't believe, Libby, the pushback I've had on bringing in this rental licensing program. There's a weekly protest at City Hall. I even had a protest at my own residence. There's a group of slum landlords that formed an association, and they were noisy. But as I remind my council colleagues, they do not speak for the majority in the city. The vast majority of the city wants to make sure that all rental locations are safe and meet building code and meet fire code. And we're not going to cater to the noisy minority that continues to put on these protests.
And okay, so what would you like to leave us with on this?
That I hope council today ratifies the recommendation to expand this pilot project citywide, and that we give our bylaw the permission to make sure every rental location meets building code and fire code.
Okay. Mayor Patrick Brown, thanks so much for that.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. All right. Obviously, the problems are not just in Brampton. I'm going to take a call from Helen in Toronto. Helen, you had an experience in North York.
Oh, yes. Two different experiences with the house across the street. That the first one, there were a lot of drugs in there. Actually, three. Somebody was running around yelling, call the cops on a Saturday. And after I called 911, the officer came to me and said, you know, we've had many calls because of drugs in that house. The second time, there were too many people living in the house. And I called I can give you his name, but I don't think that's proper, who looks after these problems in the city of North York. And he said to me, you know, we can lodge your complaint. They don't have to let us in. Great. The third time, there were 11 to 17 people living in a single family home. The man had cut the unit into little pieces and added another one at the back. And when I called that same person who looks after it, he said to me, oh, so we can go shut it down and these people will be on the street. What have you accomplished? They don't care. They don't
care. Well, I think also more to the point, Mayor Brown was telling us is that they don't, the landlords don't have to let inspectors in, which is a problem, I guess. But Helen, thanks for telling us about that. It is obviously not just a problem in Brampton, and we've seen how the results can be totally tragic. Thank you for your call. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. We'll be back here tomorrow when we have our municipal panel. We'll talk then. In the meantime, follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram, and if you have not had a chance and want to donate, go to zoomerradiothon.ca, and you can do so until next Tuesday. That's all the time we have.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one.
Welcome to Specsavers, sir. How can I help?
Hello, I'm a senior, and I've heard that for eligible seniors, of which I am one, Specsavers are giving 50% off lens upgrades on their glasses, like thinner and lighter lenses or a sun tint. For seniors.
You don't look senior. You have to be 65 or over to get this offer.
Here's my ID, which is definitely not a fake.
Yeah, this says you were born in 1877.
Happy birthday
to me. Seniors get 50% off lens upgrades at Specsavers. Conditions and exclusions apply. See specsavers.ca.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.